Welcome back to Stack Trace, your weekly podcast about Apple, news, technology, app development, and anything in between. Well, maybe not anything, but a lot of things in between. Or what do you say, Rambo?
I think all of the things in between.
All of the things in between. I mean, on an infinite time scale, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to know, John, what have you been up to?
So it should come as no surprise that I've been continuing working on my game development and, you know, working on the game that I'm working on. And I have reached a point now where I've been doing like a kind of sprint, if you will, developing new features and adding lots of new functionality to the game, to the point where I felt like now was the time to take a little bit of a break and do some refactoring, do some kind of just performance tuning, improve things, smooth out a few rough edges, if you will, like basically clean up the tech debt. Because that's one thing that I love to do whenever I'm working on more or less any project, whether it's a game or an app or a website or whatever it might be, is that I love to do these kind of tech spikes, if you will, or feature spikes where you are intensely developing new features. You're intensely like moving really fast. You're not thinking too much about your code quality and architecture and things like that, although you still have to keep it in mind, of course, but you are moving kind of as fast as you can, adding new features. But then for me, at least, it's really important to take that break, like take a week, for example, to clean things up, to make sure that your test coverage stays, you know, intact and is good. You know, I'm a weird developer. I write tests for games. I don't think many other people do that. But, you know, to kind of take a little bit of a pause and clean things up. So that's what I've been doing this week. And among one of the things that I've been working on is making sure that the game scales really well across all supported devices. So for this game, I'm targeting the iPhone, the iPad, and the Mac as a kind of primary set of devices. The game compiles for tvOS technically, and I want to keep it compiling for tvOS, but it will require quite a lot of modification and fine-tuning to make the UI work really well on tvOS, so I'm not targeting that as a kind of release platform, at least not for now.
It compiles. Ship it.
Exactly. just submit it. What can go wrong, right? You don't need the focus engine. You don't need any of that stuff, right? You don't need to render well on a 4K TV. It'll be fine. So this exercise of kind of taking this break and making sure that the game works really well across all devices kind of led me into thinking quite a lot about kind of responsive app design or responsive UI development, because that's something that you have to think about a lot when you're building something, especially on the Mac, where the user can resize the window. And one interesting kind of side effect of this work that I was doing, making sure that the game scales well from a small kind of iPhone SE all the way up to like running on an external monitor on the Mac, is that now I'm able to like resize my UI so that if you shrink the game window on the Mac down to like an iPhone size window, it still renders perfectly fine. It still plays great. So I think that's going to be a fun little side effect that people can run the game. You know, maybe they are playing with someone and they're waiting for them to play their turn, and or playing while Xcode is compiling or something like that. I think that'll be really nice. So I'll be curious to hear your thoughts on this kind of topic when it comes to taking an app and kind of making sure it scales well, both across operating systems, but also in AirBuddy, for example. I'm sure that you've had to done a lot of work making sure that all your Windows and UI scale well across all Macs, right?
Oh man, that's a whole world of pain right there. Because, well, first of all, you have to think about whether it makes sense for something to be resizable when you're talking about a Mac app. Ideally, everything should be resizable, but there are some things which really don't make sense for them to be resizable. And also by default, when you like create a new Mac app in Xcode, the window that's created, it can be put in full screen. And sometimes it doesn't make sense for the window to be put in full screen, such as the AirBuddy preferences window, for instance.
Right.
Like, what's the point of making that full screen?
You can put one control in each corner of the screen.
Yeah, have like a dashboard or something.
Exactly.
Yeah, so it doesn't make sense in that case. So you have to, first of all, think about whether it makes sense. You also have to think about minimum and maximum window size when it's resizable, because sometimes it might make sense for it to be resizable, but up to a certain point and not beyond like a minimum viable size, which allows your basic controls to be visible and things like that. And then you also have to worry about priorities of views. So if you have like a stack view or something, you have to think about which views should go away first when this is too small, or should that even be allowed? So yeah, there's a lot of stuff you have to think about. And that's not even mentioning multiple displays, which is right. a thing on the Mac. I've had many issues with AirBuddy and multiple displays, because the way you address multiple displays is was different than what I expected. So yeah, you do have to think about a lot when developing for the Mac.
Absolutely. And the first thing that you mentioned there, reasoning about minimum and maximum window sizes, that's something that Swift UI in particular, which I'm using to develop the UI for the game, makes fairly easy and fairly straightforward, because you can use the frame modifier on your root view mm-hmm. and you can set a minimum width, minimum height, and maximum width and height. And that then translates to what the user can resize the window as. So that is like a really nice side effect of using Swift UI in this case, for me at least, where, you know, defining those constraints, like what is the maximum viable size for the game in this case to be rendered at, and you know, you don't want users to be able to shrink the window down to like 2 pixels, you know, squared either. Yeah. So that has been really nice.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really important to keep in mind. And you also have some issues related to different depths. So you have like the built-in Retina display, and it's a 2x display, and then the user can move your window to an external display, which is not 2x.
And has a different refresh rate as well.
Oh yeah, there's also that. So yeah, it's a fun challenge, to say the least.
Yeah, I'm sure during the beta period, which I want to do eventually, of course, I will get a lot of bug reports regarding these types of issues. So I'm looking forward to it, I guess. I don't know, to be able to kind of get this information. So you mentioned earlier also around stack views, and you might need to kind of rethink how different views get rendered depending on the screen size. And that's something that I've been thinking a lot about as well. And one thing that I'm doing, for example, is changing sometimes the orientation of the layout of the whole view. So, for example, when you're operating on like an iPhone or something that has a very thin kind of vertically oriented screen, of course, you can run it in landscape, but you know, let's just say for portrait now, you might want to stack your UI vertically and use like something like a VStack in Swift UI or a UI stack view in UIKit. But then when you go to a more larger screen size, or when the user rotates to portrait, you might want to change that orientation to be horizontal instead. And that's something that I've been doing a fair amount, is to create like a Swift UI wrapper that enables me to, depending on the maximum or minimum width or height, I can dynamically either display it as a horizontal stack or a vertical stack.
Yeah, I think that's also something that you have to do, which is very similar to responsive web design, as you mentioned, which sometimes you'll see, like if you open up, I don't know, Apple's website, for instance, you can scale down the window and you'll see that sometimes things which are horizontal on like a desktop size window will become vertical. And I wish we would have something like more built in to do that. I guess you can do that in UIKit or AppKit using collection views and flow layouts, but there's nothing like in Swift UI, right, that will help you in that sense.
No, you have to build much of this yourself. Of course, Swift UI, when it comes to like the built-in things like lists and those kind of built-in components, they will scale really well, like built in, if you just use them as is. But in my case, for example, I'm building a game with a completely custom UI. So although I am building my UI based on those building blocks, like a button is a button and so on and so forth, I still have to kind of do quite a lot of custom logic in order to make the UI render well. And one thing that I've built, and I might write an article about this at some point, is to kind of be inspired by CSS media queries. So you did mention also responsive web design there, and that is something I've been doing a fair bit. And the idea there is that you can define constraints, really, or they're called media queries. You can say, if the window width is more than this or less than this, then activate these CSS rules. And you can do the same thing in Swift UI as well. You could use a geometry reader and you could check like what's the current width and height of this container. And depending on that, you could either activate certain modifiers, or you could even activate certain views. Like I mentioned earlier, you could dynamically shift from an H stack to a V stack. So I've been kind of been inspired by media queries and developed my own little responsive Swift UI design system, if you will. It's not that advanced, but it gets the job done.
Yeah, that's really nice. I think that's a good idea, and it's always nice to grab some ideas from a different realm and bring them into your development.
Exactly. And another thing that I think is an important point for me regarding this is that I try to do this work on a kind of component by component basis. So rather than having like an if statement where you check, like the classic is like if iPad, right? You know, where you say UI device is iPad. But that doesn't really work in this scenario, especially if you want to be like fully dynamic. You want to support multitasking on the iPad. You want to make sure to support all kinds of different window sizes on the Mac. One if statement is not going to cut it. So in my case, like I'm making these more granular decisions based on the container sizes on a component by component basis. So certain components will resize themselves, certain screens will change their layout depending on the window size, right? So I think that's also something that could be an important thing to keep in mind, whether you're working with Swift UI or UIKit or something else, is that having just one single like if statement to check for your layout perhaps doesn't scale as well as it used to back in the day. So trying to make more granular decisions around the layout without, of course, overcomplicating it and making like, so you have 1,000 different permutations, but still trying to be a little bit more dynamic and granular, I think really helps in creating like a really nice user interface for all devices.
Yeah, what I try to do, and Chibi Studio is an example of that, is I define my metrics as data. So there's going to be like a struct that provides the metrics for a given view or controller or whatever. And I used to do that just to like extract out magic numbers, and it would be like a struct with static lats properties for each metric. But what I do instead nowadays is I actually instantiate, create like an instance of that struct with like, oh, width for the whatever button and font size for whatever, and then I can create the specific metrics for iPad or iPhone or for this particular screen size. I find that to be a better way to keep your code sane, so you're not doing all of that if whatever is this device type queries everywhere.
Yeah, that's a very good idea. And also it kind of separates concerns so that your views can just ask for the title height or something, right? And your struct in this case, or whatever other abstraction you're using, can just return the right value. So you don't need to keep all of those if statements and everything inside of the view itself.
Yeah, and for more complex behaviors, I actually use protocols, and I call them personalities. So I think one of the examples is the drawer that's in the Chibi editor view. I have like a drawer personality protocol, and it has lots of things, lots of methods and properties. And then I have concrete implementations for iPhone and iPads. And then when it's instantiated, based on the current trait collection, the correct personality is instantiated.
Nice. That sounds like a cool abstraction. Really cool. Yeah, so there are many different ways to model this, of course. But yeah, I think it's just been interesting to work on this particular project now that I'm working on, that where I really have to scale things across devices and do like a multi-platform project. And yeah, just have gotten me thinking about app UIs in a different light.
Nice. So it's been, about a week since iOS 14 was released, maybe even less than that. I think it's time that we do like a post-mortem of sorts of the iOS 14 launch, which was not very well received by developers because it was with very short notice. But it seems like the adoption has been doing fine, and it seems like it's been mostly okay, right? I know you've finally installed iOS 14, right?
I finally did. So this beta season, I haven't had much of a reason to run all the betas, which I would do if I would do a lot of like iOS 14 specific iOS development, which I really haven't done much of this summer. I've been working on some iOS projects for clients and also on my own, but not really where I would have to like run the beta on my daily phone, right? So this is the first time that my iPhone X, my main phone, now runs iOS 14. And Rembo, I gotta say, I love it. I think it's great.
Nice. Yeah, I see that widgets and the ability to have like shortcuts in your home screen, which is a hacky way people have found to change the icons of apps. So yeah. You can like make a shortcut and make a launcher for a specific app and put whatever icon you want. And it's gone viral, John.
It really has. It was amazing to see our friend David Smith's app, Widgetsmith, for example.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I would think when I've been watching him kind of develop that and the things he'd been sharing on Twitter, you know, I was thinking it would be kind of a niche tool, but it totally went mainstream and like top of the app store. It's incredible.
Yeah, a static AF, John.
Yeah, exactly. But this also shows, you know, this is the thing that people who love Android have been talking about for years, right? That the fact that you can customize and personalize your home screen, change icons, do interesting things with like the background itself. Some people have been like using Widgetsmith, for example, or Scriptable is another app from another one of our friends, Simon Streving, where you could write JavaScript to create widgets. But people are using these like powerful tools to create custom widgets with like custom backgrounds and custom messages. It just shows the power of personalization and just how creative people are with it, which is just incredible to see.
Yeah, definitely. And it's nice to see that people have more freedom now to customize their home screen to their liking. And speaking of which, I would like to hear from you, John. What have you been doing with your home screen now that you've been running iOS 14? Did that change your home screen in some way? Are you doing something different than you've done before iOS 14?
So I didn't create my own app icons, not yet. I don't think maybe I have those kind of design skills yet, but who knows, maybe in the future. But what I did do immediately was that I deleted all of my own folders and I really embraced the app library. So I moved almost all of my apps to the app library, except for the ones that I use pretty much every day. So things like Google Translate, because I'm not fluent in Polish yet, so I do need to use Google Translate a fair bit. Google Maps, Overcast, the podcast player I like, Mail, and so on and so forth, right? So those are on my home screen, my only home screen that I have. I have a big weather widget on top running in the medium size. So that's displaying my local weather. And then the rest is all in the app library.
Nice. I am fine with sharing my home screen. We can put a screenshot in the show notes. If you're good with it, we can put yours as well.
Yeah, sure.
So mine is currently two widgets up top in the first page. So the first one is batteries, because I use AirPods a lot. So it's good to have the battery level right there. And to the right is carrot weather, which I'm super happy about. I love carrots, and it's really good to have carrots messages right in my home screen, which people who know carrots, the messages are interesting.
Yeah, to say the least. So I haven't been exploring much of the third-party widget ecosystem yet, because also it's not really there yet, right? Because of the thing you mentioned earlier where Apple just gave developers 24 hours, well, almost not even that worth of notice. So I'm sure that I will also use more third-party widgets as time goes on.
Yeah. And just to be clear, there are some listeners who are not familiar with the app distribution process. It's not that like developers had 24 hours to create their widgets or something. Of course, they had the whole summer to do it with the betas. But during those betas, you cannot actually submit your app for review by Apple. So that was the main problem, that like no one had a build they could send for review. So everyone was scrambling to download the Xcode GM, and they released actually two builds of the GM, which made things even more confusing. But yeah, so people had basically less than 24 hours to build their apps with the GM, make sure it worked with the GM, and submit them for review. So that was not great, but it actually went better than I expected. I think they maybe prioritized iOS 14 builds during those hours, because everyone seemed to be approved very quickly.
Yeah, and that's to Apple's credit. Like, they did address that part of the situation well, I think. They seem to have been expediting reviews for iOS 14 builds, which is good. But still, you know, if we're doing a postmortem here, I think it's still fair to say that this was not a great situation to begin with, and I hope that this won't happen again. I hope that developers will at least get a few days to, you know, make sure their app gets submitted for review in a non-stressful way. And another thing also is that we all know how it is. When you don't have a deadline, when you don't know when you need to be done, it's sometimes hard to prioritize your work. It's sometimes hard to get really like kind of rallied up and motivated and really like getting things done. So for a lot of developers also, I think when you get that concrete deadline, if you get a week, for example, that kind of just gives you that concrete target to just like get everything in together, merge that iOS 14 branch of your code into your main branch, get everything ready for release, do the final testing, and so on and so forth, right? So I think that was another problem with the situation here is that when you don't have that period of time to where you can just finalize things and really get things done, then, you know, it becomes problematic.
Yeah, definitely. But fortunately, everything seemed to go fairly okay. And I'm super happy that my app clip is finally live. And it looks like people have been enjoying the Chibi Studio app clip that I made. I shared the QR codes on Twitter. We can leave a link to that tweet in the show notes. And hopefully, if you scan that QR code with a device running iOS 14, it's going to let you play with Chibi Studio without downloading the app. And we talked about the whole process, and people still seem to be impressed that I managed to fit all of that in 10 megabytes. And honestly, I'm also impressed with myself.
Yeah, I think you should be. I think that's an incredible achievement. And, you know, App Clips is one of those things, like, I think with your implementation, for example, it kind of looks like magic when you're used to having to go to the App Store, you know, searching for the app, downloading it, waiting for it to download, launch it, and so on and so forth, right? Like, just scanning a QR code and you can edit a chibi right there. Like, that is almost like magic.
Yeah. And to do another shameless plug here, I'll be doing a workshop at TriSwift World. And if you're listening to this on Wednesday, maybe there are still a few spots left. So you can go to the website and sign up. And I was just finishing up my workshop demo as we started recording today. And I'm pretty happy with it. It's going to be using my favorite app, Milkshaker.
Awesome. Yeah, I love that app. That's really cool. So continuing on kind of the first impressions of iOS 14, one thing that I feel is that given now that I've kind of cleaned up my home screen, because the only reason I really had those folders before was to, well, categorize apps, right? I had one for like, you know, I called it utilities. That is the classic thing. Like, typically I recommend for developers not to have like a folder called utilities in their project, because that becomes what I like to call a code dumping ground, where you just like anything can be a utility, right? And you just dump all of that code in there. It grows to become really, really hard to navigate and hard to maintain. And I had a folder here on my home screen called utilities. And guess what, Rambo? It was an app dumping ground. That was like all my apps went into there basically that are not games or not one of those that I use every day. So I just feel like for me personally, the app library is such a much better way to organize the apps. And I immediately, like I mentioned, got rid of all those folders, got rid of all the extra home screens. I just have one single clean home screen. I've got the app library, and then I've got a very simple kind of, it was used to call the today view. I guess now it's the widget view, or does it have a name? This view that you, when you swipe the other way to the left?
It's the minus one page.
Right, exactly. It's the basement. Yeah. There I just keep like, there I treat it kind of like my today view. So I have a calendar widget there. I have a to-do widget there. And I have the batteries widget there as well. So overall, I feel like with this setup, like iOS itself, like Springboard, gets this super clean look. Like, it looks really clean. And yeah, I've just been really enjoying it. It looks so modern and nice.
Yeah. Also, speaking of Springboard and its cleanliness, I want to talk about a little UI thing, which I haven't seen many people talk about, but I really like in the iOS 14 Springboard. So if you have your iPhone handy, you can go to the minus one page, which we just talked about. And if you scroll down, you'll notice how the header is completely transparent, but there's a blur with what goes behind the header, and there's actually a gradient in the blur. So there's instead of being like a gradient from one color to another, it's like a gradient for the blur. Have you seen that? I think that's really nice.
So you're talking about the search box? Because the only thing I have at the top of my minus one page is a search box.
Yeah, and if you scroll so that things go behind the search box, there's a little blur gradient thingy.
Oh, right. Yeah, I see what you mean now. Yeah, that's really nice.
Yeah, I love that. I think it's a really cool effect. Too bad it's not for us, right? There's no like visual effect view that can do that. Not that I know of. So if anyone can replicate that effect, let me know.
Yeah, because it wouldn't be as simple as taking like a visual effects view and like adding a gradient to it, right? Because that would also blur, like it would blur the gradient basically.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, it's a really interesting effect. And I think it does give it some more clean look than having like a solid visual effect header or something like that.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of what I was getting to when I said that it looks so clean and modern. Kind of, it feels like with this release, Apple has really just like gone through and refined a bunch of things and just made them just like even out the spacing here and there, just make it look really nice. So I've been overall really impressed by iOS 14. And you know, it was kind of a nice surprise because of that surprise release. I was fearing that it wouldn't be the case, that it would feel kind of rushed out. But it does really, at least so far for me, feel really stable.
Yeah, and speaking of things that impress, have you been able to play around with spatial audio at all?
Not yet, and I'm really looking forward to it. Like, I haven't checked if my AirPods have gotten the new firmware, but I'm sure they have or they will. And I am planning to watch some really cool movie or something to test it out to see if it's really like Dolby Atmos, like they say.
Yeah, so that's something that it had been a long time since something had impressed me to that level. And when I was first playing with it, I was like giggling to myself like, oh, this is so much fun. Yeah, I really, really like it. And it really tricks your brain and you feel like the sound is coming from your device instead of from your AirPods. So it's really, really fun. I think you should try it out. I think you're going to love it, John.
You think I'm going to love it. I have listened to podcasts on the AirPods Pro since I updated, but I'm not sure if podcasts benefit much from a Dolby Atmos
no.
experience.
Actually, I've been trying to do some research and I've seen some people on Twitter also having the same question because Apple has not released any documentation as to like how developers or content producers can enable spatial audio. I looked at the demo they have on iOS and it's like a 5.1 surround setup or something like that. And from what I've seen on Twitter, it looks like if you play a content like that using like the standard AV player, it will work. But right. only if it's video and not just audio content. So I've been trying to look that up and doing some experiments here because I kind of want to do that for the super splashy intro we have in Chibi Studio. I think it would be fun if it had spatial audio, just because.
Just because. Oh, that sounds fun. It's probably one of those things where it reads like some standard encoded like audio formats in a video file that is encoded for surround sound, like you said, and then it just translates that into spatial audio, right? But it would be really nice to be able to explicitly address like some kind of virtual channels or something in your audio pipeline. So using something like AV Audio Engine or something where you could say, you know, play this in this specific channel, and that would then be used by the spatial audio system to simulate a surround experience. For example, for games, I think that could be really cool, where you could like kind of simulate like, you know, enemies running around you or something like that.
I think you can do that using ARKit or maybe RealityKit or something like that. And there's right. also a new API, I think it's in Core Motion, where you can actually get the raw motion data from the AirPods Pro. Currently, just the AirPods Pro support that, but I suppose new AirPods and AirPods Studio or whatever will also have the gyro or accelerometer to also support that type of stuff. And I don't have any ideas so far of what I could do with that, but I'm sure people will come up with clever things.
Yeah, absolutely. I really can't wait. I think this is a very, very exciting time for this type of audio-related technology when you could, you know, take something like the AirPods Pro, which is a very small product, right? And you could make it play audio like this. Like, that just presents a lot of cool opportunities. And I must say, like, you know, there's been a lot of skepticism. There's been a lot of criticism in the Apple community in general, you know, around Apple software quality lately and things like that. And of course, Apple's not perfect, and we have criticized them a lot for other things as well. We just talked about the surprise release of iOS 14, which was kind of disappointing. But I must say, like, with iOS 14 now, I feel kind of hopeful, Rambo. I feel kind of like, I feel excited. I feel like I want to build more iOS apps again. Like, this this feels really nice to have this release and for it to feel so good, at least so far. And again, for me, your mileage may vary, as they say.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't subscribe to this idea that's been going on for quite a while, and it seems to go in circles and in seasons or something. Apple's software is going down in quality, and then it goes back, and then it goes down again. I think that's true of all software. I do have some nitpicky things I don't like about iOS 14, but it's mostly like detail stuff. I think it's fine, and it's definitely way better than iOS 13 was, which was notoriously bad in the beginning. So yeah, I think I'm mostly fine. I did recommend to people on Twitter that they waited a little bit before updating, especially because of third-party apps. I think like Pokemon Go wasn't working at all on the first day or something, but they fixed that. So I will say now, if you're listening, it's probably gonna be fine if you update right now.
There's a ringing endorsement from Rambo here. It's probably going to be fine.
That's the most you'll get from me.
Exactly. So I think that's a good point to move on now to our next topic, which is going to be discussing Apple One. And I also have a little bit of an Stack Trace Arcade segment for you as well. But before we do that, let's take a very quick break and thank this episode's sponsor. This week's episode of Stack Trace is brought to you by Charge ASAP. 9to5 Mac is teaming up with Charge ASAP to celebrate the launch of their new Omega charger by giving away a MacBook Pro, and using their limited early bird discount, you'll be able to get this charger for half of the expected retail price. The Omega Charger is the world's first and smallest 200-watt and 100-watt gallium nitride USB-C charger. It's also the world's first charger to incorporate a graphene membrane for advanced heat reduction. Now, what that means is that this charger can be as small as a credit card, and it only weighs 220 grams, while being capable of charging up to four devices at the same time at incredible speeds. For example, it can charge two 16-inch MacBook Pros at full speed simultaneously. The Omega Charger has 200-watt USB-C ports and two 22.5-watt USB-A ports. It's compatible with all modern Apple devices, as well as many Android devices as well. And it ships with connector plugs for US, Australian, EU, and UK wall outlets, so that you can use it worldwide in over 200 countries. Find out more today by visiting Charge ASAP's Kickstarter page for the Omega Charger. The project has already been fully funded, but as of this recording, there are still backer spots available to get an early bird discount, which can get you up to 50% off the expected retail price. You'll find a link to that in the show notes, where you'll also find a link to join 9to5 Max and Charge ASAP's giveaway of a brand new MacBook Pro, which is open to listeners living in the US or Canada. Thanks a lot to Charge ASAP for sponsoring this episode of Stack Trace. All right, Rambo. So it's been a while now since we've been in the Stack Trace Arcade, which was a segment that we used to do around Apple Arcade. Like, each week, each episode, I would play a game. Sometimes you would too, but mostly it was me, because I'm mostly the gamer out of the two of us. But then I unsubscribed to Apple Arcade because, you know, for a while there didn't feel like there was any games there really that I really wanted to play. And Also similar to what I did with Apple TV Plus as well. I also unsubscribed to that as well, kind of just waiting for the next seasons like we talked about on the previous episode. But then a game came out, which is called Monsters Expedition, or the full title is Monsters Expedition Through Puzzling Exhibitions.
Oh, wow.
And the team that made this game, they had previously made another game with another very long title called A Good Snowman is Hard to Build.
Wow.
And that game for me was one of my favorite puzzle games ever. Like, I really love puzzle games, and I think I've talked about on the show previously, especially when they're like these kind of open world style puzzle games where you can walk around in a larger world. And if you can't solve a particular puzzle right now, you just can't figure it out, you can go somewhere else and you can try another puzzle. And one of my favorite games of this genre is called The Witness. We'll put a link in the show notes there. It's available on iOS, but I played it on PS4. But this one is on Apple Arcade, Monsters Expedition, and it's following that similar format where in this game, you are a monster and you're going on an expedition. Well, that kind of figures, right? It's right there in the name. But you're walking through this kind of like outdoor museum that monsters have made based on what humans were doing. So there are all these human objects in the world and there are like monsters writing explanations for what they were for. And this creates like a lot of fun, hilarious moments that I don't want to spoil any of it, but it has some clever writing in this game. But the gameplay is that you visit these small little islands, and on each island you have to cut down trees in order to create a bridge to the next island, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you also create like different kinds of structures and you can walk on stones and all kinds of things. But I've been really, really enjoying this game. It's super fun and it is quite challenging. But the good thing is that since it follows this open world design, if you find a puzzle too challenging, you can just find another way around it. So there's kind of the easy path and the kind of hard path. And the sound design is amazing. The graphics are nice. And I've actually been playing this on my Apple TV. And that's been a lot of fun as well to kind of game on the Apple TV again, which I haven't, again, done for a long time now. So I'm back on Apple Arcade, Rambo. I'm loving it. I'm especially enjoying this game. This is so far not only my favorite game of Apple Arcade, but it might be a contender for my game of the year.
Oh,
the
wow.
Prestigious John Sundell game of the year that every game developer wants to win.
That's really, really nice. Yeah, I'm glad that you liked it. I am currently not a subscriber to Apple Arcade anymore. I ended up canceling because I wasn't really playing anything and didn't see anything in the horizon that would make me want to play something in Apple Arcade. But I am probably going to become an Apple Arcade subscriber again. You know why, John?
Could it start with Apple and end in one?
Absolutely. So I've been doing the math, and I'm not done here. While you were speaking, I was doing the calculations again here. But
yeah, it's a lot of math. You have to do some serious accounting to figure out if you're going to get Apple One, right?
Exactly. But from the initial results here, it looks like it would be beneficial for me to get Apple One, even though I would have to pay a little bit extra for iCloud storage because I have the 2 terabyte plan currently, and the 200 gigabytes you get from the family plan, they wouldn't do it for me. I have more than 200 gigs of iCloud stuff already.
Yeah, I will be doing the same. I'll be getting the Apple One individual plan. I might get the family plan, but I don't think so because, well, me and my girlfriend, we use the same Apple TV, right? So we don't need 2 subscriptions to TV Plus or Arcade. I mean, I'm the only one who uses Apple Arcade, but TV Plus, we're going to watch it together anyway. So I think I'm just going to go with the individual subscription. And also, just like you, add additional iCloud storage, because it's really great that you will be able to do that from what we've heard, that you can add additional iCloud storage, because the 50 gigabytes that they give you on the individual plan is not a lot.
Yeah. And is it also like super cheap in Poland, Apple One?
Okay, so this is so weird.
Don't tell Apple.
We shouldn't tell Apple. Okay, so anybody listening, don't tell Apple. But I think they might have made a mistake around this. This is so strange. Okay, listen to this. I think I've been complaining a little bit that Apple Arcade in Poland is quite a lot more expensive in Poland than it is in the US if you just translate the currency, right? So mm-hmm. Apple Arcade in Poland costs 25 złote, which is our local currency, and that translates to approximately 6.5 US dollars. So compared to the 5 US dollars that Apple Arcade costs in the US, right? Mm-hmm. So more expensive. However, here's the weird part. You want to know what Apple One costs for the individual plan?
How much?
The same amount.
Oh, wow.
How is that possible? Like, so basically, just because I subscribe to Apple Arcade, I can just get the individual plan. It's the same amount of money. And I get all these other services, quote unquote, for free. I don't know if that's a mistake, but if it isn't, then I'm really happy about that. And I'm going to be a very happy Apple One subscriber.
Yeah. And here it's also like, you know how much Apple Arcade costs here if I convert it into dollars?
No, how much?
$1.82.
Oh, wow. So how much does Apple One cost then?
Apple One is $6.97. Let's round it up to $7 for the family plan.
Oh, for the family plan. So yeah. What about the individual plan then?
The individual plan will be $4.87.
Wow. Yeah, that's a very, very good price.
Yeah, so it's very attractive.
You will also then probably be a very happy Apple One subscriber, I get.
Yeah, yeah. I am still doing the calculations here. I'm not going to be done during this episode. And there is one question mark. We don't know how much extra you'll have to pay for iCloud. So let's say I get the family one. It comes with the 200 gigabytes of iCloud. How much will it cost for me to add the 2 terabyte plan on top of that? Is it going to be the same price as having just the 2 terabyte plan?
I would guess so.
Yeah, so I'm not sure about that, but we'll see. But I think it's going to be worth it for me, especially if I plan on having Apple Arcade again. Yeah, too bad we don't have the premier one, right? But that's because News Plus and Fitness won't be available for our countries in like the foreseeable future, probably.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, overall, I'm excited about Apple One. And for me, it's going to be a day one subscription. I'm going to get it. And, you know, I might go back and forth on whether or not I feel like I want to use a lot of Apple Arcade at the moment or Apple TV at the moment. I'm not interested in Apple Music because I use Spotify. But, you know, like having that bundle, I guess that's how they get you, right? Like having that bundle with all of those things is just going to be so convenient and nice that I will probably just keep that.
Yeah, exactly. And another question is, how easy or how hard is it going to be to unbundle something? So if you subscribe to Apple One and you decide that, oh, I don't need Arcade or TV Plus anymore, how hard is it going to be to go back to the individual subscriptions?
Right. I would guess that you just let that subscription lapse or you just cancel it and then you just have to resubscribe to Apple Arcade. Because when I resubscribed now to Apple Arcade, it was extremely easy. Like I just wanted to get the game. I clicked a button in the App Store to get it. It prompted me to subscribe to Apple Arcade. I clicked subscribe. I authenticated with Face ID and boom, I was in the game.
Cool. That sounds good.
So now we've been talking a little bit about our own kind of purchasing decisions and how we feel about these bundles and what we might do. But what do you feel about Apple's offering overall now that you've had some time to think about it? Do you feel like Apple One is a strong offering, like a strong bundle? Or do you feel like Apple didn't do enough here?
No, I feel it's really good. I've been happy with Apple's services offerings. I think, of course, I'm talking about my own reality. But what I hear from people around me, like friends and family, is that Apple services, they are very competitive in terms of price, especially like TV Plus with the free trial if you buy a product. And of course, they don't have all of the catalog that other services have, but it's like it's way cheaper than something like a Netflix subscription is here. And if you want like 4K on Netflix, you have to pay extra and things like that. So I think they are very competitive, and I think Apple One is a great offering. And it's probably going to drive more people to have these other services, which they might not have otherwise. Like, maybe I'll have Apple Arcade just because of Apple One. Otherwise,
exactly.
I wouldn't have
yeah.
it. So I think that's also another way to kind of make people not want to give up on Apple One, because they kind of like having Apple Arcade. Maybe they're not like a huge gamer or anything, but they do like having it because sometimes they play a game they like there. So yeah, I think it's overall very good.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's like each and one of these services from Apple are at the moment not like super strong. Like for me, I just happened to have this one particular game now that I really wanted to play. So it kind of got me in the door again to Apple Arcade. Plus, you know, I love playing games. So it was not that hard for Apple to convince me around this. But, you know, if you just have a very casual interest in either games or watching the Apple TV Plus TV shows or music or any of the other services, like subscribing to each and every one of those individually is probably not going to happen. But once you get that simple bundle price, it's so much more convincing, I feel like. So, yeah, I think they've done a pretty good job. I think the pricing they have in our countries, in Poland and in Brazil, makes this even more compelling. While in other territories, it might differ, right? Like, so the pricing varies depending on where you live. So yeah, we'll see how it's going to be in each and every single area around the world. But I'm pretty sold on it so far.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, Rambo. So what do you say? Should we round off this episode by doing some Ask Stacktrace?
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's the return, not only the return of Stacktrace Arcade, but also the return of Ask Stacktrace.
Yay.
And just to remind everybody, you can ask us any question that you want, whether it's about app development, Swift, our own ways of using technology, whatever really you wanted us to talk about, you can ask us any question by tweeting with the hashtag AskStackTrace. Just tweet it out with that hashtag and we will find it and we'll try to answer your question on a future episode. And the first person who has asked us a question for this one is Björn. And Björn wants to hear, since you talked about app clips last episode, what do you think of the possibility to use app clips as some kind of on-the-fly Siri shortcuts, where Siri could use an app's features without requiring the user to install the app, because 10 megabytes as a limit fits this perfectly? So, Rambo, what do you think about this? As someone who has developed an app clip, do you think that an app clip could fit well into kind of the overall Siri shortcuts ecosystem?
Yes, but I don't think it's very likely because this is very niche. Like, it's a very specific thing. But yeah, I don't see why not. They could definitely fit. The main limitation right now is that app clips can't have extensions, at least not that I know of. But yeah, it would definitely be possible, technically. Will Apple do it, though? Not sure.
I also feel like if you're going to take the time to set up these kind of automations, which, you know, take a little while to set up, even if you're used to it, like you have to create the shortcut, you have to put these building blocks together, getting the app itself, like, to perform this task doesn't feel like a big thing in this context, right? So I'm kind of curious why you would create some sort of automation that relies on a component that you don't have, right? That you would have to download on the fly. And it's maybe that could be useful when you started sharing shortcuts, because that's something that some people do. I mean, you created shortcuts for that very reason. And maybe then, like, if you get a shortcut where you don't have this particular app, it could still kind of do the work and then maybe afterwards prompt you to install the app or something.
Yeah, I think maybe another option would be for extensions to be available as a separate thing from the app that contains them.
Right.
So maybe when you submit an app, you could elect, like, oh, this intense extension, it can work regardless of the app being installed. So the system could on demand download just the extension and the app doesn't come with it. So yeah, but there are also like some technical challenges involved with that, but I'm sure they could figure something out. But yeah, that would be interesting. Like, because, and this is this involves like another problem which has been going on for a long time, but people don't really talk about it anymore, is that apps these days are huge. Like, any app for anything will be like 200 megabytes or something. And like 100 megabytes of that will be like tracking and data mining frameworks most of the time. So yeah, there's also a point to be made there that maybe apps should be smaller. Of course, there are like types of apps, like Chibi Studio itself is not a particularly small app because there's a lot of assets in there and we prioritize being available with no internet connection over being a small download up front. But there are definitely apps out there which have like a huge size and there's no justification for that other than that they include a lot of crap, basically.
Right. So we've been talking about this forever on Stacktrace, like literally 100 episodes ago at this point. We talked about this idea of like taking the idea of modularizing apps to the extreme, where instead of distributing one app, you're distributing a series of kind of smaller building blocks that can be used in various contexts. So Siri Shortcuts would fit into this, App Clips fits into this. And I think, you know, if the rumors are true and that Apple is working on some kind of AR headset, having more of this kind of functionality like App Clips and things that can be kind of summoned on the fly or summoned at will could be really powerful, where you're, you know, walking around the world and you just need some piece of functionality and it can appear like right there in front of you. That could be really cool and also pretty scary, but also pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely. I really like this idea, and we've talked about it a lot, that apps should be features, and I think App Clips achieve that to a great extent. But yeah, it would be nice to have these headless extensions and things, which we've talked about before, like you mentioned.
Exactly. All right, and our second and final question for this episode comes from Ricardo. And Ricardo has a follow-up question. This is how you do follow-up, Rambo, right? Like 50 minutes into the podcast episode, you start doing follow-up, right?
Absolutely.
Is that correct?
Yeah, definitely.
So Ricardo wants to hear us talk more about syncing data to CloudKit. And specifically, if you have an app in the App Store that relies on CloudKit, what happens if you sell the app? For example, if you move the app to another developer account, will users lose their data? So, Rambo, what do you think about this?
So, this is more like an Apple policy question than anything. And Apple's policy for transferring apps using the super simple, like I've done it before, it's actually quite simple to transfer an app to another developer account, unless it uses iCloud, or there are some entitlements which won't allow you to transfer the app, like with the quick and simple thing that you, it's basically a button in App Store Connect, and the other developer receives a link that they can go and accept the transfer to their account. But I have heard of stories, and I don't know if they're true or whatever, but I've heard stories of developers transferring an app to another developer account, and the app uses iCloud, but they, of course, they couldn't do it with the automated system I talked about, but they contacted Apple and they arranged something. So the quick answer is don't enable iCloud if you plan on transferring your app over to another developer account. The long answer is if you do sell your app and you have to transfer it, there's probably a way to do it, talking to Apple, and it might take like months or something, but it can be done. At least that's what I heard.
Right. And another option as well is to set up a separate developer account for each app, right?
Mm-hmm.
So one thing, you know, this is not financial or legal advice or anything like that. We should always say that. But one thing I've heard developers do is to create like a separate legal entity, like an LLC or something for each app, and then have a developer account for that app on that legal entity. And then if you're selling the app, you're selling the whole company, basically, right?
Yeah.
Again, consult your accountant, consult your local government, whatever you need to consult to figure this out. But that's another option, right? That you could have a separate developer account for that app, and then you could transfer developer account itself.
Yeah, and that's only feasible if you're in a place where it's super easy to open up another business, basically. Like
right.
Here, it's like a several month long process and it's super expensive, but I guess there are other countries, like in the US, I think it's a little bit easier and quicker and cheaper. So yeah, it all depends. And of course, we don't give like legal advice or anything, but it does sound like it will be a good solution if you have an app that you plan on selling. But again, if you want to be safe, you're probably going to have to skip iCloud. But then there are other things, like I think even signing with Apple is one of those things that will prevent your app from being transferred directly. But again, from what I heard, even then, if you like contact Apple, you can, there is a way to do it. It's just more complicated.
There's a lot of disclaimers in this answer. A lot of asterisks.
It's just because like we don't have personal experience with this, so we can't like say for sure how it works. But and if anyone who's listening has had any experience like that, please let us know. I would love to hear more about this complicated transfer process.
Yeah, that sounds interesting. Cool. So thanks a lot to both Björn and Ricardo for those great questions. And again, feel free to tweet at us with the hashtag AskStackTrace if you have any follow-up questions or anything else that you'd like us to talk about. But that's it for this episode. So all that remains is to thank our great sponsor for this episode, Charge ASAP, and of course, all of you for listening to our show. Hope you enjoyed it, and we'll talk to you again next week. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.